And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Connan. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, Happy New Year, Phil.
Thank you. It's our first show
of the year.
Yeah, hey, by the way, we're going to talk about sports later in the program, but I don't even know. They're supposed to play the Rose Bowl on New Year's Day. Did they play?
No, it's today.
It's today.
Yeah.
See, it's nothing sacred. This is, we're losing all sense
of nothing sacred. Occupy Rose Bowl will be in the Rose Bowl parade.
Oh, my
God.
At
the back of the parade, mind you.
All right.
They weren't invited, but.
So something is sacred. Yeah. We're going to talk today to Peter Robinson, who is a lawyer for Radovan Karadzic, who is on trial at The Hague for crimes alleged against him. And Peter Robinson is a very distinguished lawyer who has represented several internationally known accused. We'll be talking to him about this latest case and also about the bizarre closing of a case in Arusha, Tanzania. And later on we will talk to Otis Richmond about a recording phenomenon called Little Willie John. There's a new biography, and Otis is going to talk to us about well-known singer. But we're joined now, I believe, by Peter Robinson. Are you there, Peter?
I am, Phil. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Just great to talk to you, and thanks for taking the time. And I should tell everybody right off the top, peterrobinson.com. If we miss any points, people should go to that website, and you can follow all the legal work of Peter Robinson, which is would make a good book, Peter. I guess the first thing, you're headed to The Hague once again, where you are providing legal assistance to Mr. Karadzic, who is on trial there. Am I right? You're due back in court on January the 9th?
That's correct.
Actually, I've got a footnote. Because Mr. Karadzic said it is the anniversary of the Republic of Srpska, I said the 9th. I think it is actually the 10th.
Yeah, we're starting on the 10th, and I'm going to be back there by the 9th.
Yeah. Now, Peter, I want to ask you about some of your work. You cover several continents, but I guess we should learn your role in this case at The Hague is rather it's not the ordinary defense counsel. You're providing legal assistance. Is that right? How do you define what you're doing in that case?
Well, I'm helping Dr. Karadzic with the legal aspects of the case because he's not a lawyer. He was a psychiatrist and a poet and involved in politics, and he wanted to represent himself, but he recognized that he didn't know the legal matters that arise during the case. So he was looking for someone who could help him and who had experience at the tribunals in the legal issues that were involved.
So
he asked me to be his legal advisor.
How much of a legal team is he allowed to have? I mean, are you in court with him, for example, and at his elbow, as it were?
Yes, I am. I'm in court with him every day, and whenever there's a legal issue, I speak up in court, and I also help him draft the written pleadings that we, when we file motions and other challenges of a legal nature. Mm-hmm. And we also have people who are working on the facts of the case with him. We have two case managers and a legal associate, and we have two investigators in Bosnia.
Again, this is Peter Robinson, and I'm going to keep saying this, peterrobinson.com, because, you know, Peter, I'm very grateful. I like transcripts, as you know, and you make them available at your site. People can follow the daily workings of the court.
Yeah, that's correct. If you want to read the transcripts of Karadzic's trial as well as the motions and other legal pleadings that are being filed, you can go to my website and you'll find them there.
Mm-hmm. Your client has the problem, does he not, that being what they – I notice he's referred to by almost everyone. There's an expression that you seem to be using these cases of a so-called big fish. That's kind of it puts your client at something of a disadvantage. There seem to be a lot of assumptions made about him. Can you tell us what's he accused of?
Well, he's accused of basically four things. First, the siege of Sarajevo, in which it's claimed that there was shelling and sniping against civilians. Second, ethnic cleansing in Bosnia in 20 different municipalities. Third, the taking of UN personnel hostage in May of 1995. And fourth, the massacre of Muslim males in Srebrenica in July of 1995. Mm-hmm. And those four events are charged as genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes.
Mm-hmm. And has he outlined a defense? I mean, I have to say I didn't read. I began by reading the latest testimony, but did he open with a summary of what the defense's case is going to be?
Yes, he did. He gave a detailed opening statement at the beginning of the trial, and his defense. It's hard to say it in one short sound bite because it varies with the different elements of the case. But for the siege of Sarajevo, he's defending on the idea that it was necessary to fire the shells and to maintain the Serbs' position around Sarajevo because they were severely outnumbered and that the artillery was used as a deterrent for attacks against the Serbs. Mm-hmm. And also his own involvement in those events is very much in question since he issued a lot of orders asking them not to shell civilians or target civilians. For the events in the municipalities where ethnic cleansing occurred, mm-hmm. he says that most of those events occurred at the very beginning of the war when he didn't have control over the people who were doing those things. For the taking of UN personnel hostage, his defense is that the UN became a combatant when they had airstrikes that NATO initiated against the Serbs, and therefore they were entitled to take their personnel as prisoners of war. And finally, with the events in Srebrenica, he contends that he himself had no knowledge of nor ever approved any of the killings that took place in Srebrenica. So that's a very short outline of his defense to those charges.
No, I really appreciate it. And by the way, I'm as I say, if you go to peterrobinson.com, the transcripts are there. I assume that summary is there.
Well, you could read the transcript of his opening statement, and it would take you a little bit longer to discern all that, but basically it's there.
Yeah. Well, the difficulties that he faced, there's also, and I know you're involved in similar cases elsewhere, like what you were with Rwanda, there's a refugee issue as well, right, in terms of accounting for the difficulties of anybody in a command position of having transfers of civilian populations over whom nobody had very much control.
Yeah, it's definitely a situation where when the war breaks out, people want to flee to the side that they're affiliated with. And so it's difficult to discern in some cases whether the people were willingly leaving the theater of combat operations or whether they were being displaced. Mm-hmm. But there definitely were some displacements within Bosnia on all sides, and it's a question of who's responsible for that.
Mm-hmm. Something I was struck by, the testimony of the last day of testimony, December 9, by the way, he seemed to be doing a rather good job. I guess he's kind of like a pupil. He must be becoming a law, like having a law student's learning on the job. But he seemed to be doing a good job. Mr. Karadzic was cross-examining a gentleman named, I think it's Riedelmeier, who was there, as I understood the testimony, he was there to document that there had been damage done to religious institutions, particularly, I think, Roman Catholic and Islamic. And what I was struck by, and I would like to know your thoughts, it's when you bring a witness who's supposed to say, okay, here's a picture of a damaged building, and I went to the building, and there, it lost a window or there was a fire, you kind of expect that person to be an expert on fires and explosives and damage, which he purported to be somewhat. But you don't expect him to also have written pamphlets and books attacking your client.
I mean, yeah, that's true.
You're a former prosecutor. Wouldn't you rather, as a prosecutor, bring in someone who just talks about what he knows as opposed to having strong opinions about the accused?
Yeah, that's definitely true. In that particular case, the witness, in addition to his role as a cultural heritage site expert, also is very active in human rights and has very strong opinions about what happened in Bosnia. So his credibility and objectivity is definitely less than someone who simply studied the sites and can objectively report on the damage.
Yeah, looking at it as a case, I just was wondering, what was the prosecutor thinking? Couldn't you just hire somebody to take a picture of a building? And because he entered into arguments, and I really recommend everybody, please go to peterrobinson.com, go to the trial, read the transcripts, because he engages in a political argument where he thinks he knows more than your client, who happens to be from the region. It's very striking. It tells us, I think, a lot about these tribunals.
There's definitely a lot of politics involved in these tribunals, and that's what differentiates them in many ways from the domestic trials that we're all used to.
Yeah. By the way, Peter, if you were the lawyer, I mean, couldn't you ask questions such or raise this issue? I think our listeners would want to know. He told the court, this witness, that he was going to be leaving after giving his expert testimony against Mr. Karadzic. He would be going to Amsterdam, where he'd be giving a speech. That really seems prejudicial, doesn't it? I mean, couldn't somebody challenge having a witness appear who obviously he gets some notoriety from being a witness in this case? Then he stands up in front of crowds and gets interviewed on television and does a lot of damage to Mr. Karadzic.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that in many cases, people who are supposed to be expert witnesses are not really allowed to engage in those kind of polemics. But in the tribunal, the judges say that those are the things that they weigh when they decide on the credibility of the evidence. And so you can't exclude someone's testimony entirely from the trial based on lack of objectivity. You can simply bring it to the judge's attention and hope that they will diminish the credibility of that witness.
You hope that the judges are fully alert, and et cetera. We're speaking to Peter Robinson, and he has handled several really important cases at these new ad hoc United Nations tribunals. And Peter, I have to ask you, how did you get involved in the Charles Taylor matter, and where does that stand? You had to represent the lawyer for Charles Taylor.
Yeah, that's correct. Last spring, during the closing arguments, Charles Taylor's lawyer refused to proceed because the trial chamber wouldn't receive the written briefs, saying that they had filed them too late. And he felt that the trial would not be fair that to go ahead and give his oral presentation when the trial chamber hadn't read any of their written material and had only read those of the prosecutor. And the trial chamber threatened to hold him in contempt. He hired me to defend him. And ultimately, the trial chamber dismissed the contempt charges, so he didn't face any sanctions for that. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, the Charles Taylor judgment is being eagerly awaited by many people, and it's been reported that it will be delivered sometime at the beginning of this year.
But by the way, he then did not he did not end up presenting the final oral argument. Is that right?
Well, what happened was he appealed the decision not to receive his written brief, and he won. And the appeals chamber said that the trial chamber should go ahead, read the briefs, and then reschedule the oral arguments. Mm-hmm. And so they did that, and he was able to present his oral arguments.
Oh, he did. Okay. Yes. That his arguments also included he had some motions which he was expecting them to respond to, right?
One of the reasons why they didn't file the brief on time was that the trial chamber hadn't decided all of the pending issues. Yeah. And so by the time he was able to give his closing argument, all of those issues had been decided. And I think that the defense team was satisfied that they had gotten to present to the trial chamber everything that they could on behalf of Charles Taylor.
Well, I'm really glad we're asking you about it. I think I really urge everyone who cares about these tribunals or they're supposedly helping us establish truth, justice, et cetera, that you won't know unless you really look closely at what transpired, I was struck by the fact that one of the judges didn't agree with the panel that wanted to bring contempt against him. And when they had the first session, she did not appear because she said, I don't agree with this.
That's correct.
I wish that had been a story, by the way. I wish the media told us.
Yeah, well, those who covered the Taylor case closely did report that, and that was a very surprising development and one that threatened to derail the trial.
Hmm. You were also involved in another matter which everyone, certainly our listeners have heard about. This was the matter of Peter Erlander and the impact on the Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, where you were defending one of the accused. Mr. Erlander was who was also a defense counsel at the ICTR, had been arrested in Rwanda, and you took the stand, the position in court that you could not continue while he was being held, and so you were sanctioned. Can you tell us what happened there and what the outcome was?
Yeah, after Peter Erlander was arrested for statements he'd made in court at the ICTR on behalf of his client, I was expected to continue with our trial, in which we were basically making the same kinds of arguments that the prosecution had not proven any plan for genocide in Rwanda. And so I took the position that if I faced arrest in Rwanda for what I was doing on behalf of my clients, that I couldn't proceed, and I refused to proceed until Peter Erlander was released. The trial chamber cited me for contempt, but ultimately after Peter Erlander was released, they decided not to proceed with that, so I never had to face any serious sanctions.
Yeah. That extraordinary series of events there, which leads sadly to this last matter, which is the issue of the long trial, where you figured very prominently as a counsel for Joseph Zerera, one of the so-called Government One defendants. And after years of arguing the evidence and presenting witnesses, after the testimony of Joseph Zerera, which, by the way, we interviewed you about, and I know people remember that interview, that Joseph Zerera died, and now that case is, of course, proceeded. You were no longer present because your client had died. There has been a decision in the case, and the two other gentlemen, Mr. Karamira and Mr. Gurumpatsi, were convicted of some of the counts. I have to ask you, to me it's like almost like a riddle. What happens to the name of Joseph Zerera in this judgment? And he can't there is no appeal for him, is there? There's nothing anyone can do.
That's correct. Well, he wasn't found guilty of anything. It's simply they didn't decide on his guilt or innocence because once he died, the case was ended. And so the judgment that they passed against the other two accused wasn't any kind of judgment against him. So to that extent, he maintained the presumption of innocence all the way until his death.
Mm-hmm. What did you make? Could you tell us, just in summary, what they did decide and how it looks to you as a someone who argued that case?
Yeah, they decided, first of all, that there was no conspiracy to commit genocide or no plan to commit genocide before the death of President Habyarimana in the plane crash of the 6th of April of 1994. But they decided that the two leaders of the MRND party were responsible for the acts of their youth wing, the Interahamwe, who killed a lot of people during the genocide. And therefore, both Edward Karamera and Matthew Ngirimpatsi were found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment for failure to prevent and punish the crimes of the Interahamwe, as well as for encouraging those crimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, you argued at the opening of the case that there was a responsibility that the prosecutor had failed to look into to explore the fact, which is alleged in many quarters now, that the assassination and whoever conspired, which that would have taken a conspiracy, whoever conspired to assassinate President Habyarimana, who at that time was engaged in a peace process along with your former client, Mr. Zerera, should be before on, as I say, in the dock facing charges. That matter never got addressed, did it?
No, it didn't. The ICTR did everything possible to sidestep deciding who was responsible for the shooting down of that plane. And interestingly enough, during the year, there's been many judgments in these large cases of leaders, both military and civilian, in Rwanda. And all of the judges have concluded that there was no pre-existing plan to commit genocide. So that leaves you with the idea that whoever it was who shot down that plane is responsible for the triggering of the events which led to the deaths of many hundreds of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. And it's a real shame that the ICTR has never wanted to look into who it was who shot down that plane.
Yes. And I'm going to let you go, Peter, soon, but I would just remind, just ask your thoughts about this. When the tribunal opened the, I recall the chief prosecutor at that time, it was Louise Arbour, appeared, and she said the reason we're here is to end the culture of impunity in Africa. What would you think, looking at this case, how far have we gotten on ending impunity?
The ICTR has done nothing for ending impunity. In fact, it can be said that it promoted impunity by refusing to prosecute and investigate both sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm very appreciative of getting your thoughts about all this. Peter, PeterRobinson.com. Hey, and you've got a novel called The Tribunal. People should go to the website and they can get a copy of that. And we really are grateful, Peter. And good luck with your work.
Okay, thanks for having me, Phil. Bye. Okay,
bye-bye. Peter Robinson, and he is a brilliant lawyer, I got to tell you. I've been in court and watched. You know, there are lawyers you go to watch. He's one of those. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back. We're going to talk to Otis Richmond about Little Willie John.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back. Data Report. I warned you we'd be back. CIUT 89.5 FM. Hey, you can check us out, taylor-report.com. That where you would be able, for example, to access the interview we just did with Peter Robinson, if you want to inform yourself about that, the Karajic case and these alleged search for justice at the these tribunals, which some have argued are simply political exercises and equivalent of show trials, a school to which I belong, and indeed I've graduated from that school. You can also write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We're going to talk to Otis Richmond shortly, and also a little later on, Phil and I are going to talk about the corporate sport crime business and how it works. But we are joined now by, I'm going to do the whole thing, Norman Otis Richmond. Are you there, Norman?
Oh, yes, I am. How are you?
He is there. One of our phones is ringing. As you're livening up the place. There's a new biography of Little Willie John, and it has a great title. It's a Fast Life, Mysterious Death, and the Birth of Soul. I like that title, and it's co-written by his son, or one of his sons, I should put it that way.
Right.
Now, you're planning a program about Little Willie John, a very significant figure in American music. There's this thing called R&B, and I know that. How do you say R&B without saying Little Willie John? But what's your take on him and his significance?
Well, first of all, I think he was the first one really to really make it before, you know, the term soul came about, soul music or rhythm blues. He started out at 14 years old. He started out, he was big even before Little Richard or Chuck Berry. He was only 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And he had an impact, but he only lived to be 30 years old. By 1968, he would have been dead. So he only lived like 30 years old,
yeah.
And people he's basically been forgotten until recently. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, believe it or not, and this book recently.
It's almost
fever.
He should have been one of the first guys through the door, shouldn't he?
He should have.
I think we're breaking up a little bit. Are you there? Okay.
I can hear you very clearly.
All right, very good. Yeah, well, we got you clear again now. It's the more modern and more advanced the technology, the more interesting the glitches. I noticed that this book, if you probably have it in your hand, it has an introduction by Stevie Wonder.
Yes, Stevie Wonder was a big fan of Stevie Wonder's from Detroit, and so he's a big fan of Little Willie John, and I guess when I remember Willie John, listening to Willie John as a kid with my father, I can sing Little Willie John song top of my head. Little Willie John was a contemporary of Jackie Wilson, and I've heard people like G.C. Cameron, who's the lead singer of Spinners, talk about Little Willie John. Also, the Beatles were inspired by Little Willie John. They recorded a song, You Better Leave My Kitten Alone. Peggy Lee did Fever.
Fever is the one that I think most probably most widely known, don't you think?
Of course, that is because, yeah, Peggy Lee had a big record with it. And Talk to Me, it was a Fleetwood Mac song. Fleetwood Mac did a song, Talk to Me, I think.
This thing of how do you count? He was reputedly a man with a bad temper, or what they call a short temper, and he was convicted of
murder
in Washington State, and I think in 1963, and died in prison in 1968. Were these factors that caused him people to kind of marginalize him for a while? Was there bad blood with other people? Because he was about as strong a voice and reputation as I can recall.
Well, I think that the whole question of the murder was, a lot of people would argue that it was really self-defense. He had was coming to the aid of a woman, and the person, Willie John was little. I don't know, five, six, you know, it was very, very light, didn't weigh that much. And the person that he was, that was murdered was over 200 pounds, too. Mm-hmm. And he apparently slapped Willie John, and Willie supposedly defended himself, but they never could really prove that Willie John actually did it, but he had a poor representation. But in all, everybody basically thinks that, you know, this thing that could have happened was, that should have happened, was maybe some convicted defense, so he should have got off.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, now, of course, you know, with a reputation like that, he was 31. He was certainly... He'd already established his reputation. You could have given the turbulent scene that was unfolding in 1968 America, had he not died, and by the way, a 31-year-old man, he has a heart attack in prison.
Went to see him, you know, prior to his death, and he was in a wheelchair at that time, so something was wishy-washy about the whole situation.
Now, he had a sister who became a prominent singer as well.
Mabel John is still in the land of the living, and Mabel John worked with Berry Gordy in the beginning. She signed with Motown and really was one of the first artists at Motown, and she basically used to drive Berry Gordy around, and her music was very bluesy, and, you know, Berry Gordy, or the Motown sound, was more smoother, so eventually Mabel John went to Stax Records, the records in Memphis, Tennessee. He had a career there, but I think she is, and she was a Raylette. She also, she sang
with Ray Charles.
With Ray Charles, right.
They should identify her. You know, you always see those, when you see Ray Charles, now the videos and whatnot, and there you see these wonderful singers, and you always wish that, you know, that somehow they would arrange to turn it into a still and say that this is the name of this woman, and this is because they were fabulous performers.
The Raelettes were absolutely some of the greatest vocalists. They were stars in their own right.
Yeah. Now it's I wish they were all better known to us, but another name that we need to link with that of Little Willie John, and it must have been an incredible lucky person who could see this show, but James Brown used to open the show for Little Willie John. Is that right?
Oh, that is correct. And James Brown and Little Willie John had a little bit of a rivalry, but I understand that Willie was noted for his voice, and he really didn't have to do that much, you know, singing and jumping up and down. He could basically captivate people with his voice. Yeah. So James would come out and, you know, go through his dramatic things, and yes. He claims to have, you know, to have beat Willie on one occasion. But, I mean, you know, Jackie Wilson, who I saw...
Are we talking about the applause meter? We're not talking about a fist fight, I assume.
No, yeah. But James Brown, I mean, I remember seeing Jackie Wilson, and Jackie Wilson was a contemporary of Willie, and also they grew up in Detroit together. And Jackie Wilson is one of the people that influenced Michael Jackson and Teddy Pendergrass. I mean, Jackie Wilson is very, very influential. Mm-hmm. And Willie could get Jackie, you know, on a good day. You know, Willie was basically his voice, and he was a little bitty guy and very charismatic. And when a person can appeal to women and men, when the men don't want to beat you up, and the women like you, that was the same appeal that Sam Cooke had. So he was quite a character.
Yeah. By the way, I just got to tell, say, you have to, if you haven't heard his voice in a while, listen. It'll go right through you. It's amazing. Norman, you're going to be doing a program about it. Tell us about that.
Well, this Sunday on Uhuru Radio, that's www.uhururadio.com, and I will be doing a tribute to Little Willie John. I'm on from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Every other Sunday, but I'm going to come on this Sunday and put together a tribute to Little Willie John, and I wanted to talk to his, hopefully I'll talk to his sons and the author of the book, Susan Withall. She writes, I think, for the Detroit News. Mm-hmm. And it's another part of the whole Willie John story that a guy who used to be my next-door neighbor, H.B. Barnum, who was the Aretha Franklin's musical director for a couple of decades, he arranged Little Willie John's last album, which he recorded when he was out of prison. Hmm. It was on Capitol Records, which was Frank Sinatra's label. And HB was the arranger of that particular album. And HB says that in bad voice, he could out-sing anybody. That's what HB said about Little Willie John.
Yeah, well, you can't be praised like that. By the way, this book is enjoying a lot of respect, right? This is not one of those just a toss-away thing or a table book. This is a serious book.
Most definitely. It's winning all kind of accolades and awards. And I've just completed it, and I'm hoping – I don't know if they have it at a different book list, but I'm certain that
that's where Miguel, and
Miguel and Ita on Bathurst Street, they would definitely order it for you. And I recommend it highly. And, you know, his son says he's looking, you know, he wanted his father to be in, you know, to be recognized in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But there's one thing that has not happened. He wants his father to be, to have a feature film. And, you know, a feature film being made about his father. And there's a contemporary artist that, you know, people in the audience would know. Stevie Wonder says that Usher sounds a lot like little Stevie Wonder, and Usher is a great artist who I think has been overproduced now. Mm-hmm. And Usher is, I think he was born, or he grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, And for whatever it's worth, his father was Panamanian. But, yeah, Usher Raymond is one of my favorite singers.
So you think we might recruit him to play the part or to do the voice? Or
I'd like to see him play Lil Willie John. He might be a little bit too tall, but I guess, you know, you got tech. Maybe they can shrink him, you know.
They can shorten him down. Yeah,
they can shorten him down. Yeah. Technology.
They did that with Tom Cruise, who's a huge guy.
Yeah, Tom Cruise is, about 5'6", right?
Yeah, I think on a good day. I think he's probably closer to 5'3 or 4, I think.
If they were
to hear this, we'd probably both of us get sued, right?
Right. He's about as tall as Spud Webb, huh?
Exactly. Well, there's a lot of money in being short if you could play basketball, too.
Right.
But anyhow, that's great. I mean, Usher, I'm glad you mentioned the name so that people get a kind of a taste for all this. So, okay, now it's going to be Sunday at 2 o'clock on uhururadio.com,
yes, sir.
Right?
Uhururadio.com. You're absolutely right.
Great. Hey, well, congratulations on doing it. I'm a big Willie fan, Willie John fan.
You saw Willie before live. I never saw him. I didn't have that pleasure.
Yeah. Right. Brilliant guy. Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Norman Otis Richmond. And that book we're talking about is titled, I love this title, A Fast Life, Mysterious Death, and the Birth of Soul. And Phil Connors, do you remember a little Willie John at all?
You know, actually, I don't. But I remember Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke so well. But it's always there's somebody around that you don't remember who probably was leading those guys, and that's often the case. I know it's funny. He died in '68. A lot of singers died that year. I think Otis Redding died that year in a plane crash.
You know? Sam Cooke is close there,
and Sam Cooke around the same time too.
That's right. Yeah, there's. There is a morbid school of rock scholarship that says, when did this wonderful guy die? But in the case of black artists, it's often in jail, I have to say. Peggy Lee is a figure in all this, and she, by the way, did a wonderful rendering of his song, Fever, and it probably was good for him. It's just this whole thing about how a song gets knocked back and forth between performers. And at that stage, there was a strong racial barrier on music. So white performers would take, most notoriously, Pat Boone took a song called Tutti Frutti and turned it into Saltwater, which was a miracle. When Little Richard was the guy who had done it, and is the only guy who can do it, as a matter of fact. I never heard anybody else do it that
I saw you wouldn't want to hear
memory.
Pat Boone do it.
But, you know, bless her heart, Peggy Lee was a different type of person than Pat Boone, and she did a very good job. And if that's your, segue to Little Willie John, that's a good way to get to know him.
I hope he made some money out of it, because when Peggy Lee did that, that was a huge hit. And
you know, that's always the
time.
Question. Yeah. And I,
did he get paid?
How much what did he get out of that? Or was it just a kind of reflection payoff where people say, well, you want to hear, you know, I once heard a street orator in San Francisco, and he says, listen to Bob Dylan sing Blowing in the Wind, and then listen to Peter, Paul, and Mary. And he said, you'll find out the difference between real music and the other stuff. that was the case. Little Willie John was designed for that song, in the song for him. But at any rate, and the other thing is the tragic situation of a person so big in popular music that he could end up arrested, sentenced on murder, where it was some kind of a fight in a restaurant in Washington. I forget the city. It might have been Tacoma or whatever. But he ended up in the prison in Walla Walla. At the time of his arrest, he would have been 26, 27. And then he dies in custody. And, you know, where was everybody? Well, you know, he couldn't have had much of a budget. He couldn't, Otis just told us, he wasn't well defended. Showbiz is very mean business. And speaking of which, let's move from show business to another mean business, the sports business. And Dave Zirin has written a couple of good columns. Toronto is a baseball town. It has a major league club, the Blue Jays. And last time I saw them, they were playing against Boston. Now, I understand Boston has a new manager, and boy, does he bring some luggage with him. This guy, his name is Bobby Valentine.
His name is Bobby Valentine, the city manager of Stamford, Connecticut. I got to tell you, Stamford is, well, it is, as Iron says, it is the wealthiest community in the United States, and it has, it certainly was the wealthiest community in the United States 50 years ago, too. So, I mean, they have weathered all the financial crises very, very well in Stamford, because mainly that's where the 1% lives.
They haven't yet been told there are any right. financial.
No, they're not.
As a matter of fact, they're, yes, I mean.
Yeah. No. I mean, people should know where Stamford is. Connecticut is kind of a rectangle, but at the southwest corner of Connecticut, there's like a little extra like pimple going in a southwest direction. So when you step outside Stamford, you're in the suburbs of New York City. And so since the 19th century, the wealthiest bankers and brokers on Wall Street have lived in Stamford, where there's a nice little communal railroad. Gets you there.
The leader of the unions there in town who fought with Mr. Valentine. Yeah. And I mean, isn't this a story? This is a guy who goes from sports to get into some extremely wealthy community that makes him the city manager. What's his training for that? Tell us what his reputation was as a manager.
Combative, rude. My way or the highway, you know, the kind of guy would show people up, but you're not hustling, so you're off the team. That kind of guy, right?
You go to the press against a player.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he would show a lot of partisanship. So, of course, the sports writers like that. He'd be good press for it. But he's an SOB, basically. I mean, that's
and
it's the type that they like, you know, or some of them like right now. Yeah.
Well, Zyron's point is that, and this is, we talk about this because you look at the National Hockey League, you look at the professional sport, and it ain't pretty if you look at it closely. And there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of arrogance from owners who buy teams because they want their name in the paper. You know, in other words, they're not satisfied to be rich. They want to be, you know, they want sports writers following them around for sound bites, which is a way to keep themselves from being bored, I guess. And they love to deprecate, many of them, to deprecate players and to play with them like they're pawns.
Well, you know, there's another thing, too, that big bosses do sometimes. They sometimes think that the operation's gotten a little slack. Now, the Red Sox just fired a manager who bought them a couple of World Series, which they hadn't had in 80 years, and was, you know, by all reports, a pretty decent fellow. But he was not a disciplinarian in the sense he was tormenting his players. And of course, the Red Sox have never had so many black and Hispanic players like they have had recently, which is not unconnected to the fact that they won a couple of World Series. But you know the way it works in the business world. What have you done for me in the last 5 minutes, right? So the Red Sox didn't have a good year, right?
Yes.
So all of a sudden we find out, well, you know what? The players eat food between the innings, or the players, some of the players have a beer or something like that. So the manager gets tossed. The manager turns out was sick. He was dealing with a health problem that was like probably holding him back. No excuses. So he gets tossed. So then you go out and you hire the meanest guy you can hire. Zyron points out that since Valentine last got fired as a manager, and he's been fired twice, Major League Baseball has hired 85 different people, or it had 85 different hirings since Valentine was last let go. So clearly, you know, a guy who's this experienced, somebody put the word, you know, somebody out there figured he's not really the guy I want in my town.
He's a drug on the market.
That's right. But the Red Sox decided, well, you know, we're going to crack the whip now, right? No more eating between innings, and no more bad attitudes on part of minority players, right?
I mentioned, by the way, that it's curious how minds work and people buy into these kinds of arguments.
Absolutely.
When Mickey Mantle, who was the highest paid, best all, you know, talent, drank, as we now know, like a fish, a lot. And he was often
during the game sometimes.
He was also at the ball game drunk.
Right.
Now, but they had winning season. So if you have a losing season, that's because he was drunk?
Yeah,
no.
Absolutely.
And the Babe, the greatest, you know, of the white ball players before, in the days before they integrated the sport, the Babe was a fabulous player. But he had the worst habits. So if you had a Bobby Valentine around, he'd get rid of that guy.
Absolutely.
You know, what did you do? I fired the Babe. Yeah, I caught him eating a hamburger. Well, you're brilliant. No, I mean, that just tells you how dumb it all is.
But let's talk about what he did as the city manager of Stamford, right? So Stamford is not the kind of city.
Sure, stick up for the workers.
Right. Stamford's not the kind of city that would be having a financial crisis because people can't pay their property taxes. The 1% can pay their property taxes, right?
That's what I heard.
Maybe they don't want to pay them, right? So they bring this guy in with his great career as a baseball guy, and they tell him, you're going to run the cops, you're going to run the fire department, you're going to run the parks department, you know, and you're going to go negotiate their labor contracts. So he's one of these guys who comes in, cut slash burn. You don't get a pension anymore. You take a 20% pay cut. You're gonna lose this. You're gonna get that. Well, by the way, when we hire the kids to replace the people retiring, we're gonna pay them half what we're paying you. This is what he's doing as a city manager. Well, you know, I mean, I think the happiest people about him getting the job managing the Red Sox have got to be the people who work for the city of Stamford, because I mean, just getting a guy out of town is gonna be like already improve their life at work. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that is the kind of guy that the Red Sox seem to want to hire right now, and it's I got to say, by the way, the owner of the Red Sox is a big supporter of the Democratic Party, and he always said, well, you know, we do have a history in this town of having discriminated against black ball players. Well, that's all over with me, and also, so he was Mr. Nice Guy. Yeah. All of a sudden, he didn't win the pennant this year. Now he's not Mr. Nice Guy anymore. Now,
Well, it's. A further focus on this matter of sports and what they do, I think this is very important that in the Zirin columns, he is arguing. He said he can't take it anymore. He says he's not going to watch this. And we ought to really talk about it here and elsewhere. With the strange emphasis, the overemphasis on sports, which causes a semi-professionalization, almost pure professionalization, is professionalized on the management level. That is, his point is, he doesn't want to watch any more college sport because they have all these contracts with networks and with advertisers and whatnot. And the money from all that, of course, some of it goes to university, but there's a coach at Ohio State that I understand is going to get something like $5 million a year. Five-year contract, $5 million a year. And the players, what do they get? Well, if they're caught accepting an automobile to drive or getting a job given to them so they can survive, they are booed and hissed and humiliated, and their parents are disgraced. Actually, there's a young man now who's a starting quarterback in the NFL who his family was put through a great deal of humiliation and insults by people who, of course, know them from nowhere. But nobody looks at the salaries of all those coaches, the guys who are, you know, leaning over into the faces of these young black athletes and calling them names, calling them cowards, kicking them and pushing them and telling them they've got to do more and better and risk their knees, risk their necks, risk concussion. And those kids, they don't get nothing out of this. And he points out, they say, oh, well, they get a scholarship. Well, I had a brother who got a scholarship, and he ran on his first game in the new place we had the scholarship. He got his knee smashed trying to tackle a man, and that was the end of his scholarship. He couldn't play ball, no more scholarship. I mean, and he is one. I mean, how did I happen to know him? They're right across the board. Thousands of young athletes try to get a career through playing a dangerous sport, and most of them do not make it. And then they do things to help themselves make it, such as take steroids. How is it that the offensive linemen now from tackle to tackle in the NFL and throughout actually the collegiate ranks are at 300 pounds?
300 pounds.
300, that's not 300 possible.
I mean, when I was a kid, a guy that was 200 pounds was considered heavy.
Yeah, by the way, they can't tell us, oh, we're all bigger. We're not that much bigger. There is some.
No, the species didn't evolve in 20
their
years.
Bodies. Right? Yeah. And by the way, for every 300-pound guy you read about in the papers, why would anybody call me? At any rate, for every 300-pound guy who's in the newspapers, there's a whole army of them who didn't make it. Where are they? And then as for him, the guy in the newspaper, when he does wrench his knee or when he gets a final concussion where they say, well, we don't need you anymore, what happens then? Nothing. But the money keeps rolling in. That's why Zirin says, I'm all right, I quit. I'm off. I'm done. And oddly enough, I opened this by talking about you were going to watch the Rose Bowl. But the other element of it is that we should be focused on is the militarization of our sport, which is taking place. We are all now told, okay, we used to have to sing the national anthem at the beginning. Now you have to have the America the Beautiful during the seventh. Is that what the song is?
Yeah, God Bless America.
God bless America.
And in Yankee Stadium, they arrested a fan for disorderly conduct because he insisted on going to the washroom during God Bless America.
Yeah. Because his government is engaged in an unprovoked war on a foreign people who did not agree to be in a war with them. He's the one punished. But there's the other thing of bringing people in what I would call battle gear, battle fatigues, are now becoming, what's the word? The French say de rigueur or whatever.
That's the word.
Did I get it right?
That's
okay.
A la mode.
a la mode.
Well, you can say that too. I
use that with pies.
The fashion is, a la mode means according to the fashion. The fashion is now for military personnel to appear in public in battle fatigues.
That's wrong.
Not in dress uniforms.
And that was against the law when I was in the service. Yeah. You could not be off the base in your fatigues or certainly not anything which is resembling camouflage. It's an insult to the civilian population. If you're going to go out, you go in your civvies or you wear they call dress. I have they call dress greens. So now that they want us to say that's the next thing you're going to say, well, carry your gun and wear your helmet. I mean, it's ridiculous. And they put them all on the sidelines, and then we have to have the phrase, "Oh, there's the real heroes." You know, you guys are just pissing us. I mean, you work for a living, you're looking for a job or whatever. You're not. That's a real hero. This is ridiculous. It is war propaganda. We didn't have a debate about this. The American Congress didn't declare war on anybody, and the Canadian Parliament actually didn't either. But we have to have this thing of, can't have a slide-on show without people in uniforms to whom we're supposed to pay a kind of special regard. That may – and it isn't good for them and it's not good for us because we have a duty to occupy politics. We are supposed to make up among ourselves in a democratic way the decision whether we want to do this or not. And if we don't, that's our business. It's not to, somebody not to, supposed to intimidate us. But it is really, they've really crossed the line and more. I think, by the way, it's going to come to haunt them. They're feeling their oats and they think, we've got everybody intimidated. Look at the number of professional ball clubs that wear camouflage now on special occasions, like the San Diego Padres.
Oh, those guys. Yeah. By the
way, couldn't they call them San Diego Priests? I mean, what is this? it's kind of a dumb name in the first place. Then we have the Washington Redskins. I mean, this is we should be fighting more about this. But that's because these teams belong to one or two guys who are multimillionaires. Unlike the Green Bay Packers, I hope they go ahead and defeat the whole world because that's the only publicly owned team in North America. You can actually buy stock, and the people own the team, which is part of the way of solving all
you
that.
You can buy the stock, but you won't get a dividend from it, and you can't go and peddle it on the stock market. You only sell it back to the team.
It ain't for sale.
It's not for sale.
The Packers
right.
are not for
yeah.
sale.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's important stuff in my view. The International Action Committee is a great organization, and folks will know about it. And there's a New Year's message has been issued by Ramsey Clark, one of the founders of it. And indeed, he's called the founder singular here. So I think he's the founder. And they've been in functioning for 20 years of activism. They are asking people for support. And if you go to Global Research, their site, a wonderful site, by the way, globalresearch.com, the statement, an appeal by Ramsey Clark is there. He reminds people that the International Action Committee has been very principled, has opposed those with the greatest power, Britain, France, the United States, who are attempting through NATO and other alliances to impose their will on the Middle East and on Africa. They opposed the intervention in Ivory Coast, which I think was courageous and brilliant, and thank goodness they did it. They opposed the bombing of Libya, which, by the way, was to protect civilians, and they, as Rick Rossoff told us, more than 9,000 bombing flights, missions, and where nothing was harmed, that they protected the civilians, and they tell a fairy tale like that. Well, if you go to the International Action Committee, you know what really happened. They were among the sponsors of Cynthia McKinney's traveling to Libya, risking her life, a very courageous woman. So I go to Global Research have a look at the message by Ramsey Clark. And in the final minutes here, we are now in 1812. I'm sorry, 2012. It's 200th anniversary of 1812. I get my centuries confused. But at any rate, we are going to be be inundated with discussions and whatnot about the War of 1812 and its significance. And I find it all kind of ironic that the 13 colonies, our cousins, Brother Jonathan, as he was called, rose up in rebellion against the British and became traitors overnight. And there was a lot of fighting, a lot of suffering and whatnot, and they went their separate ways. And it was a relatively small country with a small army. And the great power was Britain. And it was more interested in the years following beating up on France, and France was rather interested in beating up on Britain. When they say, when the word 1812 is spoken in Europe, they know what you mean. They think of a famous overture. Phil does. And but, of course, we had this encounter, bloody encounter. And it's leading to odd. We're going to have to spend some time on this because it seems to be our present government, the Harper's group, are trying to find a special significance in it to tell a story. And I'm going to call it the Tory story. And it's already headed in a funny direction. I'll just pick out one case. The National Post, which is known to say nice things about Harper, of December the 20-something. I should wear my glasses. At any rate, they have an article titled A Forgotten Canadian Hero. And the article argues that John Norton should be basically on a par with or perhaps replace Tecumseh in our memory when we talk about the War of 1812. Now, and I'm going to say why they think that. John Norton is described often as a native leader, and in some ways he was. But he was born in Scotland of a Scottish mother, raised in Scotland, and joined the British Army because he hoped to fight the French. He ended up transferred to North America. Brock wanted to fight the French. This was not what wasn't on his agenda. But Norton, a Scotsman, came here and was ended up on the doing work with the British on the Grand River. And so when you talk about, and he participated in the War of 1812. Tecumseh is from Ohio, the Ohio Valley. From the Appalachians to the Mississippi, and from the Ohio—I should say—the Ohio River to the Mississippi, and the British needed him desperately. He was the leader of a new Confederacy, the Northwest Confederacy, and he committed his people not by the tens or the hundreds, but by the thousands as an ally of the British. And let's remember, the British, he didn't meet anybody he thought was a Canadian. He was dealing with the British. And Tecumseh engaged in several of the major battles, as the most important, the most famous, is that at Detroit. But the later battles, when they were in Ohio attacking American forces there, where they were defeated, unfortunately for them. But what is the sad, as we all know, the story of Tecumseh is he gives his life. He led all these Native Americans. He dies in Ontario, and Confederacy is basically broken, and as a result, is dealt out of the agreement and loses, it is the biggest loser of the War of 1812, unquestionably. Norton, of course, continues on as a sort of a British guy and civil servant, and he's supposed to be, just because he was always there, he's supposed to get equal ranking. I mean, this isn't, it tells you where this Tory story is trying to take us with the War of 1812. It's not being honest about why people were fighting and who those people were. So I would urge people to take care when they consider the, you know, the fate of Tecumseh and of a man like Norton. And just a little footnote for the author of that piece, A Forgotten Canadian Hero. One of the reasons he's forgotten is he died in Laredo, Texas. and he was born in Scotland, died in Laredo. He might tell you a little bit about his commitment to the British, too, by the way. It's a long story, but we're going to be talking a lot about the War of 1812. This is the Taylor Report. I want to thank Carol, and I want to thank Phil, and remind you, write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. And the brilliant Mr. Peter Robinson and, of course, Otis Richmond, we appreciate them today, and we'll see you next week.